Chelsea tonight.
Okay, thanks. Hello, everyone. So my name is Rong Yu from Renmin University of China. Actually, it's in Beijing, pretty close to IOP, actually. Okay, if you have been visited there. So today, I'm going to talk about something related with the electronic correlations in the iron-based superconductors. And also, it is actually interwined with this multi-orbital effects, which I think is very interesting. Okay, so these are my collaborators, but it is an incomplete list. So I list the main collaborators from Rice University and Professor Chimiao-Si's group. And also, I work with Dr. Zhenxin Zhu at Los Alamos National Lab. These are the theorists. And recently, we also collaborated with Professor ZX Shen's group at Stanford for the ARPES, and also with Professor Peng Cheng Dai's group at Rice for the neutron scattering. And here's my outline. So I will first give a very brief introduction to the electron correlation effects in the iron-based superconductors. And then I'll move on to the main topic of today, which is a metal insulator transition in multi-orbital models for iron-based superconductors. And I will first introduce the formalism, which is a slave spin theory. We applied it to the multi-orbital model. And then I will focus on the mode transition in both iron nictides and also in iron chalcogenides, and particularly for this alkaline iron selenide. We actually find a very interesting orbital selective mode phase there. And then I will move on to the pairing amplitudes in the superconducting states. And there, we recently find an interesting orbital selective pairing. And finally, I will give a brief summary. So as we know, there is a big family of the iron-based superconductors. If you just list not all, but most of the interesting compounds, they have very different structures. And if we try to give a classification to the left, I think they belong to the space group of P4/AMM. And this 1-2-2 structure has a different space group. But then if we look at this from the chemistry point of view, basically, we have two classes. One is this nictides, and the other is chalcogenides. And today, I'm going to show that there are still some common features in these two classes, but there are also some different, very interesting different electronic properties. Okay. So from the experience of studying the cuprates, we know that it's very useful to first take a look at the parent compound, the electron properties of the parent compound. And if we look at the parent compound of nictides, and we find that it is a band metal with a relatively large room temperature resistivity, that is almost reached to this Alfie-Rigel limit. And both the DFT calculation and the ARPES experiment show that the Fermi surface of the parent nictides consists of multiple sheets of Fermi surface. It means that multi-A orbital will contribute to the low energy physics for the nictides. And then the neutron diffraction result find that the ground state of the iron nictides is actually antiferromagnetic with a pi zero, or you can call it a collinear antiferromagnetic order there. And this is actually very interesting. So now people believe that the spin fluctuation around this antiferromagnetic ground state will be closely correlated with the superconductivity once you dope the system. But this is really a hard problem. So here, I just try to ask a simpler, much simpler problem, a question. So that is, can we understand the origin of this antiferromagnetic ground state in the parent nictides? And the answer is yes, we do. But then we came up with two answers, actually. So one is basically from a weak coupling theory. There, the antiferromagnetic ground state comes from basically this Fermi surface nesting between the hole pocket near the gamma point and the electron pocket at the zone boundary. And on the other hand, there is another strong coupling theory. So basically, within this picture, the understanding of this magnetic ground state comes with the interacting quasi-local moments. If just a form a square lattice with a nearest neighbor and the next nearest neighbor J1, J2 coupling. And when the next nearest neighbor coupling is dominant, the ground state is just a pi zero antiferromagnetic. So here we see that which theoretical proposal is closer to the physics in real material. It actually depends on the degree of the electron correlation in the real materials. So then we can go back to the experiment and try to find some evidence of the electron correlation strength. So first, let's take a look at the optical conductivity data for the parent iron nickel. And there, the experimental data shows a substantial suppression of the Druid weight, which suggests a considerable electron correlations. And also, the neutron scattering data find there is a relatively large total or integrated spin spectral weight. It just shows that there could be just a quasi-local moment in the system already in the parent nickel. And I also want to mention that besides this spectroscopy evidence, there's also this evidence from the transport that the very large room temperature relativity suggests that this is a real bad metal regime. So then, consider all of this evidence. We said that we can find that actually there are considerable electronic correlations in the apparent iron nickel. So how about the iron chalcogenide? And here I will comment the experiment I found a very interesting compound is alkaline iron selenide system. So there, actually depending on the iron content, you can either find the system to be a metallic or even an insulating. So for the metallic compound, the RPS data show that the Fermi surface consists of only the electron pocket and no hole pocket near the gamma point. And for the insulating compound, the neutron results show that the ground state is also an antiferromagnetic, has also an antiferromagnetic order. But it is there is also this ordered iron vacancies, which is coupled to this antiferromagnetic ground state. And the antiferromagnetic ground state consists of a very large ordered moment, which is above 3 mu V per iron. And also, there is this recently discovered compound, this single layer iron selenium on top of this STO substrate. And there, the RPS data find a very similar Fermi surface topology to the alkaline iron selenide, which consists of only the electron pocket and a no-hole pocket there. And both the RPS, STEM, STM, and transport measurement suggest that there is a pretty high TC for the superconductivity, which can be as high as 60 Kelvin or even up to 100 Kelvin. And so we know this. And then we find that for the iron chalcogenide, it seems that it's rather different, a little bit different from the iron nickel. So I think it's very helpful to compare the electron correlation effect in the nickel and in the chalcogenide. So here I just pick up two compounds and compare the optical conductivity data. And for the iron nickel, I just already showed that there is a substantial reduction of the Druid weight. And if we go to look at this iron alkaline iron selenide we find that the Drury wedge is almost completely suppressed there. So this would suggest an even stronger electron correlation effect in this alkaline iron selenide. And then we tentatively propose this simple phase diagram where the U over T means we have some Hubbard model in mind, and this will label the strength of the electron correlation. And then this red dot shows that there's a mode transition there. And we can tentatively place the parent iron nictides and the parent alkaline iron selenide on top of this, on two sides of this axis, two sides of this mode transition on this axis. Also, one is, for the iron nictides, it is a correlated metal. And for the parent alkaline iron selenide, we propose that it is a molten insulator, actually. So then, for series, then should be very important to study how a mode transition takes place in a multi-orbital model, specifically for the iron-based superconductors. Because if you look at the parent compound, it actually consists of 6 electrons per unit cell. It's an even number. And also, if you look at the model, we consider a multi-orbital Hubbard model there. And the Hamiltonian consists of a tight bending part, a kinetic energy part, and an interaction part. And the interactions will consist of many terms there. And then, depending on the strength of, say, the J Hund's, the Hund's rule coupling, and you can get a very different ground state. So this is a very complicated problem, actually. But then if we go back to the simplest case, which is you have just a single band Hubbard model. And the easiest picture to understand this mode transition is just this Brinkmann-Rice picture of this mode transition. That is, when you increase the electron correlation, there going to be a transfer of spectral waves from the low energy coherent part to the high energy incoherent part. And then when you cross this mode transition, basically what happens is this coherent spectral weight just suppressed. And then the incoherent part just develop the lower and upper Hubbard bands. So here, we need to find a appropriate theoretical tool which can access directly to both sides of the mode transition. And then this is what we call this U1 slick spin theory work. But then this is actually a generalization of the previous version by Luca Di Medici. This is actually have a Z2 gauge structure. But we generate to have a U1 gauge structure there. And basically how it works, it just rewrite this electron operator in terms of a slick spin operator and a fermionic spin on operator. Then we need a constraint to limit the Hilbert space to this physical sector. And then we find it's pretty clear and easy to use this Schwinger-Boson representation of the slick spins. Then express the quasi-particle spectral weight, Z, in terms of the slick spin operators there. And then we perform a Hubbard-Strong-Weyl transformation to decouple the spin-ons and the slick spin operators. And we obtain the effective Hamiltonian for both of the operators. We solve this Hamiltonians self-consistently. And here we note that for the spin-on operators, actually, we at this midfield level, we find that this is just a free fermion. So, but here the slick spin operator is gonna renormalize the electron or the the spin-on dispersion. And what of this slick spin method is it is possible to touch the three possible ground states, the three candidate ground states. So, if the ground state is a metal, actually, it corresponds to an ordered slick spin with a finite Fermi surface. But if it is a ground state, it's a multi-insulator. This corresponds to the disordered surface spins with a zero quasi-particle spectral weight, but you still have a finite spin-on Fermi surface there. And for the kinetic energy part, we just take a 5-octo tight bending model from this reference, which can represent this RPAS Fermi surface topology. And this model actually consists of the partially degenerate orbitals. So then this is the phase diagram. And here we find a metal to molten insulator transition in this system for the parent iron nictides. And the most insulating phase consists of a crossover from a low spin mode state to a high spin mode state at the atomic limit. And then, very interestingly, in the metallic phase, we find another crossover from a weakly coupled metal to a strongly coupled metal. And what does this mean? So we can understand this by doing this two scan. At two different J Hund's value, but increasing the correlation U. So if we start from the lower value of the J Hund's, so basically the quasi-particle spectral waves just simply goes down all the way when the system is approaching to the mode transition. But if we do this scan at a larger Hund's rule coupling, what we see is the quasi-particle spectral waves goes down as we reaches this crossover regime. And then inside this strongly coupled metallic phase, and the quasi-particle spectral weight is substantially reduced but not zero. And then you find that the quasi-particle spectral weight becomes strongly orbital dependent. So there we find a very strong orbital selectivity inside this strongly coupled metallic regime. So how about the mode transition in the metal to insulator transition in the alkaline iron selenide system? There, I will show that the mode localization is enhanced by the ordered iron vacancies. And here is the phase diagram. Since in this system, there can be different phases, and at least one phase will have this root 5 by root 5 ordered vacancy. So then, we do the calculation for on two lattices. One is a full square lattice, standing for the vacancy disordered or no vacancy case. And the other is on a depleted square lattice, standing for this root 5 by root 5 iron vacancy order. But we fix the electron filling to be n equals to 6, correspond to the still the parent compound. Okay. Then the phase diagram here, we show that it's pretty similar in two cases. And it's also very similar to the iron nictide phase. There is a metal to molten insulator transition. And there is also this crossover line inside this metallic phase. But what's surprising is that there's an additional phase, which we call it orbital selective mode phase in the metallic in the metallic phase. This is something different from the iron nictide. And I can put by comparing our theoretical results with the RPAS data, actually we can have a estimate of the value of the J Hund's and the U, and that is what I put here as this green cross. So if we put what this J and U values correspond to the real material, then we find that if their system consists of no vacancy order, then it is basically a metallic ground state. But if the system becomes a vacancy ordered, let's see, then it just works as a reduction of the kinetic energy because you have an expansion of the unit cell there. So basically work as a band narrowing effect of like a 20% to 30% of kinetic energy reduction. Then immediately this is enough to push the system from a metallic phase to a insulating phase, already inside this multi-insulator phase. Yeah. So what's the nature of this orbital selective mode phase? There we see that the quasi-particle spectral weight Z for the XY orbital vanishes. It goes to zero. inside this orbital selective mode phase. It just indicate that inside this phase, the XY orbital is fully localized, but all the other orbitals are still itinerant. And we find that there are several factors which can promote this orbital selective mode ground state. So one thing is, since there is a finite level splitting in the system, so the XY orbital is on the topmost level there. So for this filling n equal to 6, it's actually easiest to keep the filling of the XY orbital to be at half filling, which is a necessary condition for motor localization. And then another one is we have calculated the density of states projected to the XZYZ orbital and to the XY orbital at a non-interacting limit. And then we find that basically the bandwidth correspond to the XY orbital is narrower than the XZ and YZ orbital. This would suggest that the U-critical for the mode transition in the XY orbital should be smaller in this orbital. So then, as an additional factor, if we have enough strong Hausdorff coupling, this will suppress the interorbital fluctuations, which also promote this orbital selective mode. And it's very interesting that we find the orbital selective mode phase can survive finite temperature and finite doping. So this actually gives us the opportunity to experimentally observe the orbital selective mode physics. And we recently have collaborated with the exchange group at Stanford and to use ARPAS to detect the orbital selective mode physics. And here is a comparison between the theory and experiment. So the theory plot actually shows the evolution of the temperature evolution of the quasi particle spectrate in the XZYZ orbital and the XY orbital. And we find that the XY orbital experiences a orbital selective mode phase, becomes most localized at higher temperatures. And note that the inverse of this quasi particle spectrate is proportional to the mass enhancement factor. And already at a very low temperature, the XY orbital has a very large mass enhancement there. And this is clearly shown in this blue line, which corresponds to a XY hole-like band there. And at high temperature, this band, say, just disappear. And this is fully consistent with the experiment. And this has been actually shown in this Ming-Yi's talk on Monday. And we know that for the alkaline iron selenide, there are several different competing phases. So one is this insulating phase with a Rho 5 by Rho 5 iron Wickson order, denoted as this 2-4-5 phase. And the other is just a superconducting phase. So one question is, how can one think about to connect these two phases? And we suggest that there is a phase diagram which use the orbital selective mode phase as a pathway to connect these two different phases. So the horizontal axis is electron doping, and the vertical one is the strength of the iron vacancy order. So then we, along this axis, since the order vacancy acts as enhanced electron correlations, and there is a mode insulator along this axis, then we can tentatively put the insulating phase on this axis. And since the superconducting sample actually do not consist of iron vacancies, and also is the normal state is a normal metal, so we just put this superconducting phase on the other axis, on the horizontal axis. And then any physical path would connect these two phases would actually cross this orbital selective mode phase here. And recently, there are some experimental finding. Other phases can also be stabilized, which I think it could be just along this physical pathway. Okay, so with this in mind, I think we can now have a much clearer picture for both the alkaline iron selenide and for the iron neckties. So we propose this phase diagram. So this is the carrier doping, and this is the electron correlations. U over W is the Hubber U over the total bandwidth. So then at a commercial interfering, there is a mode transition. And the parent necktie and the parent alkaline iron selenide are just located on two sides of this mode transition. And if we dope both systems, and both of them show superconductivity at finite doping, and if the distance of the doped compounds for both the selenide and the necktie are, the distance to the mode transition, if the distance to the mode transition is comparable for these two compounds, then we expect to see a comparable superconducting TC in these two materials. Although we see that the Fermi surface topology of them can be very different. But in order to see the superconductivity, actually the spin fluctuation is very important. So can we have a simple model to understand the strength of the spin fluctuations in the system? So I think we can show some preliminary result by studying a one-band Hubber model. And we use a slave rotor formulation, which is pretty similar to the slave spin formulation. And we introduce a O2 rotor to separate this spin and charge degree of freedom. And then by integrating out the high energy part of the rotor, we obtain an effective exchange coupling between the spin-ons. And then this is a numerical result for the J effective exchange coupling, and we see that it's actually maximized at the mode transition, eucritical. So this would suggest that these spin fluctuations will be the maximum at the mode transition. So then for study the superconductivity in a bad metal, it is reasonable to propose this multi-orbital TJ1, J2 model. And here the TJ1 and J2 are both orbital dependent. And we just decompose the exchange interactions in these pairing channels and consider the intra-orbital pairing. And we studied the pairing amplitudes for both alkaline iron selenide and iron neckties. Approximately they correspond to almost the same doping. And then we find that depending on the J1 and J2 values, the leading pairing amplitudes, pairing symmetries are basically the S x squared times y squared A1G in competition with the D wave B1G. And interestingly, we find that for the alkaline iron selenide and for the iron neckties, if we compare the overall pairing amplitudes, they are actually comparable, which actually suggests a comparable superconducting TC. Okay, so now we want to take a look at how the orbital selective electron correlation will influence the pairing. So then basically we can just tune the exchange coupling ratio between the XY orbital and the XZ and YZ orbital, which I don't know, this RO here. And we basically find this phase diagram. And very interestingly, we find at a large portion of this phase diagram, the pairing amplitude is strongly orbital dependent. And the blue and red one show that either the XY orbital or the XZYZ orbital become the dominant and the leading pairing channels. Now, very interestingly, to the left of this phase diagram, the pairing symmetry is A1G, but to the right, this is B1G. And we find that at an intermedium G1 or G2 ratio, there is a S wave B1G channel, pairing channel, which can be stabilized. This could be a candidate for this alkaline iron selenide. And if we fix this R0 equal to one, we can still find a very strong orbital selective pairing amplitude. And then this will give us an anisotropic superconducting gap along the electron Fermi surface when there's a mixture of the orbital characters. So further, if we look at the neutron resonance peak in the superconducting state with such a orbital selective pairing, then we find that the spin resonance peak can be even split into two peaks, correspond to two resonance peaks there. And this has been, these results actually are quite consistent with a recent RPAS experiment and a neutron scattering experiment in this N-doped sodium 111 compound. And here's my summary. I will just leave it there. And thank you very much for your attention.
Questions?
So for your calculations of the potassium iron selenide, you didn't discuss the spin order with that. Did you include spin order in the calculation?
For which one? For the pairing or for
the potassium iron selenide?
No, for the pairing or for the Mott transition?
For the Mott transition.
No, we didn't consider the spin order.
Okay, so
in the paramagnetic phase.
So the paramagnetic phase in the vacancy ordered system is at very high temperature, above 500 Kelvin. So it's magnetically ordered below that, as mm-hmm. Peng Cheng and others have shown. So I'm wondering whether, if you take the magnetic order into account, whether the Mott transition is necessary to get the insulating character, or whether with the vacancies and magnetic order, you might get an insulating state.
I think this
otherwise.
Is a very good question. So here we actually address only this paramagnetic phase, which is the easiest way to see the effect of electron correlations. And if the antiferromagnetic order, say this spin, the magnetic order is considered, and I think there's still possible to see this molten insulating phase for this compound. But it should be just this antiferromagnetic insulator, not just a paramagnetic MOS insulator.
This is a very basic question, but could you provide any intuition for how the DXY orbital mm-hmm. can be Mott localized when it hybridizes at the single particle level with the other orbitals?
Yeah, so I think I have listed several factors which can favor such a localized state in the XY orbital. So first one is there is a level splitting, and the XY orbital is not degenerate with other two T2G levels there, but the XZ and YZ are degenerate there. And one is if you look at this electron filling in this XY orbital, it's closer to half-field system. So it makes it easier to be more localized. And also the bandwidth for this XY orbital is actually narrower than the XZ and YZ orbital in the non-interacting limit. So this is partially also due to this degeneracy of this XZ and YZ orbitals there. So if you combine all these factors together, basically what you can get is the XY orbital is actually the easiest orbital to be more localized.
Sorry, very simple question. How do you derive the TJ1, G2 model from a microscopic basis?
How can I derive it?
How did you derive it?
Okay. I think formally it would be very hard to derive such a TJ1, G2 kind of model in the metallic phase.
No, just start with, like we do for the one band Hubbard model. You can
sure.
start with it, you can project double occupancy and get TJ.
Similar, actually.
Do you get exactly this model if you do the same, TJ1, J2?
Actually, there are several ways to derive an effective model for the, in this bimetal phase. But if you really want to get something like a TJ model, you can get from a strong coupling expansion, this kind of thing.
But do you get do you get exactly this Hamiltonian that you showed to us with spin halves?
Then it depends, actually. So usually you have to consider what is a ground state manifold, right?
Exactly, because you have right. S equals 1 or S equals 2, so that's it's not right. obvious to me
but
at all that you're going
to
get
if you really want to consider the pairing, then I think you have to consider a multi-orbital like a TJ model. Otherwise, if you have a pretty large spin, then it will never work.
It's a question you maybe said and I missed. Do you have an initial idea of how large is the reduction of the bandwidth in these alkaline dope selenites by the vacancies? Like how much the vacancies reduce the bandwidth? Because you assume that the ones with vacancies move in the phase diagram
yes.
to the mode insulating phase, so I guess that is that's mostly due to a reduction in the bandwidth.
You actually ask the amount of the kinetic energy reduction.
Yeah.
I think it's about like about 20%, about 20%.
But do you have is there any estimate from calculations?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
There is.
Wrong. I don't see Subir here, so I'll ask question in his absence what he asked you 2 years, 2 days ago.
Okay.
That is, oh, he is. Oh, sorry, Subir, I apologize. Right, I'll ask question of my own. So, Wrong, is there an intuitive explanation of why increasing temperature actually favors orbital selective mode transition? Because naively, if you start from, a phase and then you increase the temperature, I'd expect it to get metallic. Not the other way around.
Not necessary. So, I have something here. It's actually from a textbook. It's a phase diagram. So basically, this is what I find in this Fedeka's book. And so basically, forget about this SEW insulator there. I actually don't believe it should be always a SEW there. But you can find an antiferromagnetic insulator at the ground state. But here, what I'm talking about is actually above this T-nail. So basically, you are inside this paramagnetic phase. And there, you can have a temperature-induced metal-to-insulator transition from here to here.
Right. But what's the intuitive explanation? Is it based on the entropy argument?
If you do not consider, I think it's actually a very good question here, because it actually related with the nature of this insulator. So if here we do not consider any of this antiferromagnetic correlations, and then the entropy carried in the molten insulator phase is actually larger than in this metallic phase because it's just a Fermi liquid. And then if you increase the temperature, basically you see that you got to go from a smaller entropy phase to a larger entropy phase. And I think this is how the temperature will just drive this transition. So this is just a one band version. But if you think that you have a multiple band, and one band will go to this metal to insulator transition, but all the other bands are still attenuant. So basically, this is a naive understanding.
One question. Let me ask the last one. Since you put the question, since you put a lot of numbers, first, what control of calculations do you have? Terms of theory. And second, let me ask the second question right away.
Okay.
You showed Z factor at relatively high temperature. Mm-hmm. How you define Z factor at high temperatures?
Oh, okay. That's a good question. So, should I just one by one?
Yeah.
So, first, I don't think I put so many numbers. So, it's actually indeed there are so many numbers, but they are actually the tight bending parameters.
No, you put critical value of U on the phase diagram.
Sure.
So the question was, what's the control about this kind of phase diagram?
Okay.
Yeah.
So basically, we just obtain a phase diagram. And there are only two tuning parameters, which is the U, Hubbard U, and the Hornsby. And all the others are just from the tight bending model.
It's but just you're not saying that the calculations have infinite accuracy. It's mean field, probably.
Okay.
There are corrections to mean field.
Okay, so the tight bending part actually from a LDA calculation, which compare to this, this tight bending model is actually by comparing the LDA results. There I can say almost nothing, because you have to have those numbers. Mm-hmm. And I do think that those are reasonable. And then basically you have only two tuning parameters there, right? And so I don't think I have a pretty large freedom for this. And the second one is if I go to a high temperature, and how can I still define this quantum particle spectral weight then, right?
Yep.
Okay. So basically, these are just not that high. If you compare the temperature to the Fermi temperature, and then basically you find that this is still at a very low temperature. And there, I think we do have a control of we still have a good definition of this quantum particle spectral wave. Yeah.
So far. More questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, now we move to the last talk of the session, and Fisher from Stanford. Elastoresistance measurements as a probe of pneumaticity in iron arsenides and chalcogenides.